guest, Natalie Martinek. How are you? Welcome to Outward Unleashed.
Oh, thanks, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
It's entirely our pleasure. Maybe before we get into some of these big topics, you can let our listeners and viewers know what keeps you busy. How would you describe your work?
I'm fascinated by bad behavior that I see in institutions, in society, in families, in our friend groups. And I like to unpack what's going on driving our behavior when we all want to have a peaceful world, I imagine. So that's what keeps me busy.
That is fascinating. I think people are kind of drawn to bad behavior in a sense, you know, far more than good behavior, just in my kind of anecdotal observations. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think we like drama. We like things that are entertaining and stimulating, and peace is not that sexy or interesting, unless, of course, you're interested in how peace the conditions that create peace, which I think we should all be interested in and actively working towards. But humans love drama, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, for sure. And I suppose that, you know, the rise of the sort of true crime genre has just gone from strength to strength in recent years, hasn't it? I think we like bad behavior in conjunction with something grisly as well. A lot of our darkest instincts seem to capture the attention. But this isn't purely just morbid curiosity with you, obviously, because you're researching it, you're trying to unpack it and understand it, and not only that, provide ways for people to deal with it and not be manipulated in certain ways. So maybe, one of the key focuses you have is narcissism, of course. Maybe you could explain to people exactly what narcissism is, because I think this term narcissism sometimes gets colloquially used and not necessarily clinically used in the way it should. How are you defining it?
Yeah, it's a great opening question, because narcissism is used mainstream by everyone. I think we all like to call people who behave badly narcissists, whereas it is a clinical diagnostic label, and it describes certain personality traits where that person is controlling, domineering, entitled, self-obsessed, think they're superior to everyone else and everyone else is inferior. So there are people who live like this and think they are the sun and everyone revolves around them. Whereas when I talk about narcissism, I'm talking about interpersonal narcissism, which is our tendency to want to dominate or try to dominate in order to feel comfortable, safe, secure. And the reason why we're doing that is because we're likely trying to protect ourselves, defend ourselves. We feel insecure or threatened by what the person is saying or doing or not saying or not doing. And it's mostly unconscious. So I talk about the unconscious automatic behaviors we all have that we reenact with each other in order to feel better about ourselves or feel stronger, especially when the other person is doing something that's making us feel a little bit inferior, or inadequate, or insecure.
Oh, right. Well, please, feel free to give me an example of one of those. What are some of these things that I could perhaps do better to recognize in myself, in my interactions with my fellow humans?
Yeah. So if you've had an interaction with someone, a conversation that you get along with, and then you, after that interaction, and you thought it was fine, and you started feeling afterwards deep shame or angry or guilty, something happened in that interaction that made you feel that you weren't good enough, that you weren't inadequate, but it wasn't obvious in that conversation what that could be. So there was a little bit of a power struggle, and there was something that occurred in the way that the other person was talking to you, where they were dominating or they were telling you that their version of reality is superior to yours or more correct than yours. But because we're so used to these types of interactions, because we probably grew up with them, they're just in our society, we wouldn't know what that thing was until we start to pay attention and go, okay, what are they doing that is bringing up this sense of inferiority? Not that they're causing it, that there's something in this interaction that is it's not great for me, and I need to find that out.
That's interesting. So I think we've all had interactions where we've come away feeling less than great about it, and we sometimes can't really put our finger on it. You know, there were no raised voices, there were no open disagreements, no kind of hostility or threats, but something's a little off. So I suppose if you're kind of unconsciously being dominated by somebody else, in a sense. Is the person who's making you feel like this aware they are doing this? Is it an unconscious thing for them, or can it be a multitude of things?
It's a good question, because it depends on the individual. Some individuals intentionally act this way because, again, they're feeling, well, they need to feel superior. So they're doing things like what's known as gaslighting, where you share your opinion about something and they counter it with, no, this is the way it is. And they say it with such authority that if you're not true to yourself, or you're not very secure in your own way of thinking, you might start to believe that that's actually the better way of viewing things, and then you adopt it. So, and once that person, you allow that person to do that to you that one time, it's more likely to happen again and again and again. And if there's someone who is a bit vengeful or trying to get back at you for something you said or did or didn't do that made them feel inferior, they're going to keep that up to eventually erode your version of reality, your grip on reality, till you start feeling like, you know, you're losing your mind.
Okay. So I suppose, I mean, just interestingly, I mean, where would you say, in what population would you find the most number of narcissists in terms of, you know, sex and gender? Would you say it would be male or female? Is it pretty even? Because I think you would find in generally, and I imagine this is correct to say, that most extreme behavior is more often found in the male population than the female population. Where does narcissism fit in the whole gender divide?
This is interesting, because I think it depends which narcissisms have been studied. So I think the one that has been more obvious and therefore easily studied are the overt forms of narcissism, like malignant or grandiose narcissism. So you think about political leaders or public figures, where they need constant attention and affection and to be in the spotlight, whether it's positive or negative news. So those are the more obvious, that's a more obvious form of narcissism. So it's more easily studied and assessed. Then there's other form of narcissism, which are covert. So vulnerable narcissism, where a person centers their victimhood, and that's the way they assume control over someone else, because people who are open-hearted and like to, you know, care for other people, nurturers, tend to be drawn in by people who, you know, feel weaker or that they pity. But really, some of those people use that to take advantage of the do-gooders and control and dominate them. So that is less obvious. And I think this predominates a lot. If you think about women bullying women in the workplace and women on women aggression specifically, these are the things that we don't, aren't as obvious. So by the time you realize you're being bullied by another woman, it's already too late. So the covert becomes more overt. So that's, until that became known, it was harder to study. So in terms of who's more narcissistic, it's tough to say, because we all have these traits in ourselves.
So, I mean, I suppose then the question can be, I mean, you just mentioned then about, you know, politicians and famous public figures, and a few names instantly come to mind who could fit that kind of definition. Is there a case really of that society or certain, prestige positions in society, you know, wealth, fame, rewards having a sense of narcissism? Is this an evolutionary trait we have, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's associated with our ability to survive and succeed in any sort of environment. It's part of tribalism. So if you think about groups who follow particular, or they're part of a particular movement, there's a groupthink that's established, and that's necessary to have pride about your tribe and to enable it to survive and to support each other. If you look at also institutions, workplaces, corporate environments, narcissistic leadership tends to be the preferred leadership. So people come across as very competent and confident and charming, charismatic, and these are often associated with being competent. But unfortunately, it's not the same thing as being competent. But these are the things that attract other people and woo other people to form alliances and loyalties. And before you know it, people are being elevated for positions or status in any social setting because of how much you get along with them. But what some of these people are doing are taking advantage of their attractiveness or their charisma and the naivete of other people in order to bring them on board and then become protected by them. So this is a feature of society, or what can be called as a cluster B society or cluster B organization, cluster B being the suite of what's known as personality disorders, like narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder. These have become features of our everyday interactions in some cases.
Yeah, I will definitely pick up on that in a second, because I think that ties into one of my next questions. But before I do that, if anyone's got any questions for Natalie about narcissism and her work, please get them in the comments now, and I'll get them to her as soon as possible. But this idea of kind of personality disorders and narcissism, it kind of tangentially brings me on to another topic and issue that I know you're focused on, something I've been focused on for quite a lot, not in the same sense, of course, but this idea of social justice activism. Now, I've vocally opposed this for the longest time, even when it's channeled in the direction of causes I, you know, care about and agree with, such as, you know, maybe environmental issues, anti-racism, things like that, because I tend to find these very tribal group of activists do more harm for them causes than good. And there's a lot of, I think, what's been termed virtue signaling involved, where it's more about affirmation and getting recognition rather than affecting any change. And I suppose, just to tie into your work, is this, I mean, it feels almost taboo and a little bit naughty of me to say this, but when I look at some of these individuals, my radar, or my alarm rather, goes off in the sense of personality disorder. I can't necessarily define it, but I know something abnormal's going on, and I know instantly I don't want to spend a second longer in their company. Now, please, can you explain what perhaps is going on here in the realm of social justice activism that links into your work?
Okay, so I mean, this is a tricky topic, because activism is important. There's lots of injustices, yes, in this world, in society, in you know, our communities that need to be addressed, and people with genuine disadvantage and you know, oppression, and so there's a need for rectifying and improving situations for others. And then there's what I call the social injustice warrior, which is what you've just described. People who get attracted to a cause and they make it their whole passion, which sounds okay, but then basically the cause becomes their means for attention and significance and a sense of feeling superior, because in order to feel like they could do something, they have to choose a more vulnerable group to protect or defend or support or bring in, you know, to support anti-racism or whatever the cause is. So you need to have a group that is lesser than you, more oppressed than you, more vulnerable than you, for you to be able to use them to, you know, advocate for their needs. But the way you're doing it is really not necessarily going to help them, because you probably likely don't have the skills to be able to do things you're advocating for, but you think you do because you have a lot of humanitarian goals. But what you're doing is just signaling and, you know, creating drama and keeping it alive, stoking it so that you can continually have attention. So the way you would do that is through being divisive, polarizing, and in doing so, your efforts might not actually have any benefit to that group that you care about and can actually cause harm. So that's the social injustice warrior.
Social injustice warrior. I will be stealing that, Natalie. Thank you very much. So, I mean, how do we kind of reduce or limit our own contribution to this never-ending cycle of drama and conflict that seems to be caused by these kind of personality types and narcissists?
Yeah. So a main framework that I've drawn on for many years is called Cartman's drama triangle. So basically it describes three roles that we continually reenact. And you'll see that once I talk about it, and you'll start to see it everywhere. So in order for there to be a perpetrator, there needs to be a victim. And as long as there's a victim and a perpetrator, then something needs to be brought to justice. Therefore, the third role is the rescuer or the hero, the savior, who comes in to bring justice and protect the victim. But sometimes the perpetrator or the victim is the actual perpetrator. But depending on our perspective or the the lens, the information we're using to decide who's the victim and who's the perpetrator. We might be trying to save the victim who's the perpetrator, which happens a lot in bullying situations. The bully comes, makes themselves the victim, poor me, and you feel bad for them because you're not hearing the other side of the story. You're not thinking that there is another side of the story, and you start to feel sorry for them and want to support them and feel like there's been a great injustice, and you come in to want to protect them. But what you're doing is protecting the bully, and the real target is, you know, has been smeared and everyone's turned against them. So it's being aware of our tendency to be drawn into this drama, and one of the roles of the drama triangle. So as soon as I go, there's a victim perpetrator, I'm often, you know, triggered to want to do something because I don't like injustice, but I might be contributing to the continual drama. And by me jumping in and trying to save person who's not suffering life and death situation, but what I perceive as the victim or the persecutor, I can start to be seen as the victim or the persecutor by one of the other people in this little triangle. So be aware of the roles that we're seeing ourselves and others in, and often resist trying to jump in and save until you have more information to work with.
That's a good answer. So when you said Cartman's triangle there, my mind, like many listeners, have went straight to South Park. Then I quickly checked myself and just thought, don't be stupid. Cartman's clearly a philosopher you've never heard of. Maybe you can just clear that up for me.
Yeah, so it's Stephen Cartman. He's a psychiatrist.
I'm glad you cleared that up. I was literally like, oh, so you're a South Park fan? And I thought, no, that's stupid. That's clearly stupid. So somebody I haven't heard of. Thank you for clearing that up. Another question we've had from Ray J is, does the education system not create narcissistic behavior now?
Does it not create? Is the question.
I think they're asking if the education system creates narcissistic behavior, just the general system we have for education.
I think it can, because again, you have some children who are very good at pandering to adults and adults believing them. So if they have great excuses or they're, you know, mean to other kids, but they, you know, bat their eyelids and, you know, are seem super sweet or super smart in class, then they get away with being able to be terrible to other kids. And so if there's no incentive, there's no discipline, there's no acknowledgement of this behavior, then there's no incentive for the child to, you know, change and act differently. So that child ends up growing up into potentially an adult bully, someone who features strongly these narcissistic traits, because there hasn't been a correction because they've discovered they can get away with certain behaviors. Same with the child who, if you view that child from a victim lens and you don't see that they have strengths and resources to work with, then they get away with using their victimhood unintentionally because they're children to be able to get through life and have people do things for them. So again, as they get older, they discover they've discovered techniques to be able to have their needs met by other people. So there's no incentive for them to change. So they end up becoming more of the vulnerable narcissistic type of behaviors.
Okay. Well, I mean, talking of incentives, you eloquently described the triangle for us there and how to reduce our impact on drama. But I'm supposed to be many people looking at, like we've rightly pointed out, narcissism can get you the top job anywhere. It can make you famous. You can be a president, perhaps. Some people might just be looking at that as a model for success and thinking that's the way you do it, and I'm going to kind of mirror that behavior. What would you say to that approach? I mean, is it the best way for fame and fortune? Is that just a sad truth of the matter?
It's one of the, I think, the more popular ways to fame and fortune, especially nowadays. You can become an influencer. And if you follow the right approaches and, you know, work the algorithms to your advantage, you can be famous for just doing anything. And so we as a society are enabling this because we're the ones who are making these people famous. They don't just happen. They need a fan base. They need, you know, agents and other enablers to be able to take advantage of that person and their fame or their talent. So we are part of this problem if we see this as a problem.
Yeah, you mentioned the influencer aspect of things there, which only really could go from strength to strength thanks to something like the internet. Is the internet just creating more and more narcissists? Is that a tool that's been weaponized in the great war of narcissists?
Yeah, I think so. I think social media specifically and you know, video, YouTube, our ability to just be seen all the time, that definitely, you know, creates an addiction where you do something, you get a lot of positive feedback, you feel good, you want more of it, more of it, more of it. Because if we don't have a good sense, solid sense of security, we have our own things that we have, relationships in our life that are nourishing, then we don't necessarily need these other avenues to get the attention and the affection and the love and admiration. So it becomes addictive and you don't necessarily realize it's happening. But the more you get that attention, the more you become dependent on it, and your whole life and actions become about that attention. So you're occupied all the time by how do I maintain this attention, or how do I keep growing it? So it does, you do lose your mind a little bit. You lose your grip on reality, because this is not how we necessarily function in a society that, you know, paying too much attention to yourself is never going to be a great thing.
I agree. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, how best to empower people then to recognize when they're, you know, in the presence of a narcissist or being, you know, directly manipulated by a narcissist? Are they like trigger signs, you know, warning signs you could say that might jump out to people more than others?
Well, again, it depends on the individual, but what tends to happen is we get attracted to certain people. So say if I'm not the narcissistic one in this example, I'll meet someone and I will think, wow, they're really cool and they like me. Wow. Okay. That's our number one red flag, that I need this other person to approve of me and accept me. And I feel a bit inferior or intimidated. And the fact that they like me makes me feel better about myself. That is already your setup. You're set up to enter into some sort of, if the relationship continues, there's already a power differential in this relationship. They're already better than you and superior to you because of how you see yourself in relation to them, not necessarily how they see themselves in relation to you. But if we're talking about a narcissist, they already think they're better than you, but part of their thing is getting as many people to like them. So they keep supplying themselves with attention and affection and resources and whatever else they need. So they're going to do things to make you feel good being around them. So you're going to want to connect with them. You're going to want to bond with them. So seeing that there's somebody who barely knows me, but is saying all these great things about me, wants to give me all these gifts or, opportunities based on the tiny fraction of information they know about me, I'm actually suspicious. So that I think is the one thing that we can do at the very beginning of our interactions. Some of us are very easily trusting because people make us feel good. So therefore we're going to trust them, but that doesn't make that person trustworthy. And we find out down the track that they were not trustworthy. If they were, you know, at the beginning, giving lots of attention, affection, compliments, etc. Down the track, the first time I do something that annoys them or goes against their expectations, I'm going to hear about it. And then I'm going to feel guilty and I'm going to want to make it up to them. And so I start pandering to them to restore this power dynamic until it happens and again and again and again. And each time the severity likely increases. So again, this is with somebody who's high on the narcissistic scale, because you keep doing things that goes against their fantasy and ideal of you. And so they get very upset that they're betrayed. You're doing something that betrays them and they make you feel it. Until you do something to correct it. But they never do this to you. If you tell them that they're doing the wrong thing by you, they'll do everything to make you feel guilty for ever saying that to them. And they'll find all sorts of defenses and arguments to, make you wrong. So there's an expectation that you're always going to appeal and please them and placate them, but they don't do that with you ever. They're always right.
That's a good answer. I had a good question from Paul. Is narcissism learned? So, I mean, is like a lot of clinical conditions, I suppose they can be hereditary, I imagine. Is narcissism learned behavior? Is it something that you can be predisposed to in a way?
I think it's helpful to think about a developmental trajectory. So as children, babies were born completely dependent on our caregivers to give us love, attention, affection, nourishment, safety, all that. So that is what narcissism is. It's something that we don't necessarily grow out of because we haven't developed independence, ability to regulate ourselves, to feel safe and secure with other people. We're hugely distrustful. We haven't had our needs met. So we've had to discover ways to get our needs met by other people, just as we have as babies, but it's unintentionally. It's automatic as babies and as children, you know, to a degree until, you know, certain things happen and we don't mature out of that. So you see adults who are just emotionally dysregulated, immature children in adult bodies. So think of it like that. That might help understanding rather than something we learn. We could learn narcissistic behaviors in order to get ahead, like what was described with some influencers or becoming famous if that's your goal. So you just learn the methods or you adopt the methods to be that way because that's what we know can work towards that success. But if we think about it as, you know, traits, it's not necessarily learned. It's just something we never outgrew.
It's a good answer. And you've said as well in your work that, you know, saying no is a superpower. What do you mean by that? In what situations is it empowering to, you know, say the word no?
So if say you're in a work environment and, you know, you're just having, you meet with a boss or not necessarily boss, a colleague, and they start piling on you, they start telling you off for something, or they start dumping their, you know, emotional problems on you out of the blue and you didn't see it coming. No might be a good thing. And you don't necessarily need to say no, you say not now, or I see you have some stuff going on. This is not a good time. I'm busy. So there's different ways of saying no, but it's acknowledging that there's some behaviors that are not going to be helpful to me. They're going to help the other person. But at my expense, sacrificing something in myself, and then I have to deal with that later. So I'm just going to say no to this right now. So it does require confidence to be able to do that, which is harder when there is a power differential, like say a boss or manager and you as the employee, harder to say no. But it's just even thinking I don't want this or not this can be very helpful towards ultimately creating some boundaries of how people can interact with you.
Yeah, that's well explained. Natalie, this has flown by. It's a fascinating topic, and I think we could probably all benefit to learn more about narcissists and how to manage them and just, you know, make sure we're not one. Maybe we are and we're not aware. That'd be the biggest twist here, wouldn't it? Maybe you can just let people know where they can find out more information about your work and your writing, please.
Oh, thank you. So I write on the platform called Substack, and my Substack is called Hacking Narcissism. And you could find me on the website hackingnarcissism.com and on lots of socials like LinkedIn and X and Instagram. Thank you. Natalie, thanks for having me, Stephen.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much for speaking to us. Take care.
Have a great day.
You too.